Welcome back to our second and final segment of our conversation between Aaron Zellman and his guest, Robert Meyer.
Before we leave the subject of money, let's talk about gold. You know, there are people who think you should have it, people who think you should wait to buy it, people think it's going to be $3,000 an ounce. What is your take on it?
Well, let me start with a qualification. Gold is, without question, the most difficult commodity of some 35 major commodities to trade. The reason is it has a commodity price component, it's a very critical industrial metal, and it also has a monetary component in that people look at it as the money of last resort. They look at it as real money, and you have a very articulate, albeit small, group of advocates for a traditional gold standard so that the amount of gold a country owned would restrict or determine how much money it could issue. What we tell our clients presently is a basic formula that, given the current situation, having roughly 7 to 10% of the total dollar value of your investment portfolio in gold is probably, on balance, a good idea, but to not look at it as the end-all and the be-all for your financial security. You could have sat on gold through the 1980s and 90s and missed some truly huge moves in the stock market. On the other hand, given what we're seeing globally, if gold should move up from the 720 level it's at now, I would say the effective range of expectation, if people buy gold, they should expect to see it fall to, say, 520 or 540. That would not be out of line. And on the upside, assuming things continue to deteriorate, it would not be unrealistic to expect a gold price in the $1,500 to $1,900 range, and that could happen very, very quickly. Gold currently is moving daily in sometimes $20 to $40 to $45 price ranges, and previous to the onset of the current problems, it was common that gold would only move, say, $3 to $5 a day. So it's the kind of investment that you don't want to try and chase. You want to integrate it into your overall portfolio and understand that it's also a commodity and at times subject to deflation.
What do you make of the international scene concerning finance?
Well, I think that there are a lot of countries, and I think the evidence shows, that are in worse trouble than we are. I would start with Europe, where as a percentage of GDP, they're spending a lot more money trying to bail out industries and the public and health plans and so forth, and particularly Great Britain, or formerly Great Britain, I should say, although now it's just referred to as Britain. And the Chinese are in trouble. Their stock market is down 70%. And internally, one thing about China that's a message that never really gets across, and that is that internally and historically, China has been highly unstable. You're talking about, let's be very conservative and say, 700 to 1,000 different regional tribal-like areas. And many of these are in conflict. And you have this city displaced persons problem. You've got about 160 million Chinese that have moved from the country to the city where there's no infrastructure to accommodate them, and they're sitting in tin shacks or sleeping in ditches three blocks from multi-billion-dollar luxury hotels. Well, their economy has gone into such a severe retrenchment that they now have an immediate internal refugee problem, and my understanding, this is running very quickly up to about 160 million Chinese that basically have nowhere to go. Plus, you have a serious shortage of eligible women for marriage because of the one-child-only policy, and that's really starting to bite demographically. Well, what do you do when you've got a 20% surplus of males between the ages of 16 and 30? Well, you put them in an army. That's exactly what you do with them, because there's nothing else you can do with them. You can't put them to work in factories or anywhere else with the way the economy there is collapsing. So you've got a highly unstable situation in China. And Latin America and, of course, Africa is a dead letter. It was originally 300 different tribal areas, which the British and the Germans and the French cruelly forced into artificial countries, and in many cases forced groups of tribes that had been historically enemies for centuries and pushed them into the same countries, and hence you have this chronic instability in Africa. And, of course, the Mideast speaks for itself. So we have made this all worse by a wide margin. The U.S. military, you know, through the decades, everyone talks about America as the country of peace. And, you know, why do they hate us? Well, why does the world hate us? Well, the military, U.S. military, has been actively involved in unseating or changing political leadership in over 90 different countries. We currently have military bases in 131 countries, and we're engaging in operations and maneuvers in close to 170. And this all started in the late 1800s, and we're now paying the price for that. The potentials for retaliation, 9/11. I don't mean to be disrespectful to anyone who suffered from that, but relative to what we've done in various parts of the world, on a raw accounting basis, with the World Trade Center, we technically, from using wartime calculus, we got off really easy. The Wall Street Journal had a staggering article, but it got little attention, that recounted the fact that since Bill Clinton took office, and I'm not blaming him for this, that the United States had fired over 3,000 cruise missiles into tribal and regional territories around the world with whom there was no declaration of war, nor were we officially or formally involved, if you will. Well, if you're doing that kind of thing around the world, you're going to get some people pretty mad. And that's a whole other issue, but the point is we're reaping the whirlwind of that now. Our total military budget is 40% of the world's total. Our military research budget is 70% of the world's total. But the rest of the world is solidifying technologically, and many of these countries we've been beating on relentlessly for decades, and they're going nuclear. We may morally find these countries abhorrent, but the issue becomes, does a free republic operating under a constitution with constitutional guarantees engage in this kind of frequently arbitrary worldwide intervention? This is going to have more consequences for us, and because no one will stop it. And we've had the same Republican/Democratic, if you will, interventionist foreign policy since the Spanish-American War. There has been no fundamental difference, and I seriously doubt that there will be under Obama, or would there have been under McCain. And this, of course, is the wild card, because the more we intervene abroad, Dr. Murray Rothbard, a very astute libertarian economist, remarked once that history is crystal clear that when you have a one-time republic that condones and expedites a sustained policy of aggressive foreign interventions, and by extension, legislation of adult nonviolent choices domestically, that when you do that, the ultimate consequence of that aggressive foreign intervention requires increasing domestic controls and emergency powers to keep the domestic economy and populace organized and controlled for this global effort. And that is exactly what we are in the middle of right now. Per capita, we've got more people in prison than any other country except Russia, and over 70% of them are in prison for purely nonviolent personal choices, like smoking marijuana on a Saturday night rather than drinking a bottle of beer. And, of course, all of this is building, and it's fuel for the police state. I gave a speech some years ago that was quite popular, and the title was How the NRA, National Rifle Association, is Shooting Itself in the Foot. And I went through a very detailed analysis of how when you prohibit a substance like alcohol in the 20s or marijuana or morphine or whatever it might be, you create new crime waves and violent ones because the purveyors of these now very profitable substances can't seek recourse in the courts of law, so they fight it out in the streets. And the murder rate in Chicago, for instance, when the Volstetter alcohol prohibition law was repealed, the biggest problem in my town, this town, was drive-by shootings between beer distributors. And there hasn't been a drive-by shooting between beer distributors since the Volstead Act was repealed. In fact, the murder rate steadily declined well into the 60s until the drug war was ramped up. Now, the police state, this fascism, is fueled by these drug wars. And incidentally, drug illegality, if people really wanted to do something to chop so-called world terrorism off at the knees, they should repeal the laws on drugs like cocaine, which were in common use in America, even by the founding fathers. Cocaine has 1,000% profit margin from the time it's bought in Afghanistan until it hits the streets in Tulsa, in Miami, in Chicago, or wherever. 1,000% profit margin. That comparable consumption rate or profit margin in a free market, as it once was, controlled only for purity, you're talking about something on the order of maybe a 7 to 10% profit margin. So all of that would go away. The nationwide gang problem. What does Los Angeles have? I believe it's 1,100 or 1,200 organized gangs, formerly organized gangs. They can only exist for one reason, drug illegality. They make more than major corporations. It's a $190 billion cash business. As long as drugs stay illegal, this domestic fascism problem is going to get worse and worse and worse because the people, the public says, we want to stop this, and we don't care what you have to do to stop it. I'm not worried because I don't use drugs. Search and seizure, forfeiture, I'm not worried. I don't use drugs. Wiretapping, do whatever you want. The most telling quote about emerging fascism in America, I think number one has been the systematic attack on private ownership of firearms. I feel very deeply about that and always have. But secondly, there was a very influential German theologian who stayed in Germany and at the end of the Second World War uttered a very, very telling statement that every American should take to heart. He said, I'm paraphrasing now, I might add, when the Nazis came for the Jews, I said nothing because I was not a Jew. When the Nazis came for the mentally feeble and for the socialists and the indigents and communists, I didn't say anything because I wasn't a communist and a social indigent and I wasn't feeble-minded. And then I realized in 1945, that they were coming for me, and that what had happened was everyone in Germany was now a Jew. And the saying became, at the end of the war, among the general populace, my God, we are all Jews now. So out of control became the police and the domestic use of the military, etc. And in the United States, we are moving on the same path where someday, to paraphrase, tens of millions of Americans are going to look at their savage, ravaged, and destroyed historic civil liberties. They're going to look at imponderable levels of regulation. They're going to look at children being co-opted into so-called community service, and I certainly think we're going to see another draft. amplified by the use of immigrant soldiers, illegals creating foreign legions for the United States. I think that's a baked-in-the-cake certainty. And they're going to look at all of that, and they're going to say, my God, I am being treated like a drug dealer. And then they're going to all say, in essence, spiritually, my God, we're all Jews now, just as Germans commonly said when they realized what they created through the 30s and 40s became totally out of control.
I suppose gun owners will be faced with the same situation, that they will all begin to think, well, now we're all Jews because we're gun owners.
Exactly.
Especially with this new administration.
I would totally agree with that. And I give people one piece of advice. I think that this is situation, and I'm not saying it has to be this way. I mean, there are bright spots that do emerge, and it's not an all-in-one forecast. But I've told members of my own family, and I tell people publicly and in consultations with clients and over dinner, I say that given the current situation in the United States with the effective destruction of the Republic and the surgence of mob rule called democracy, and given what the government now can do to people arbitrarily with no recourse whatsoever, I strongly encourage people to do everything within their power to persuade their children and their grandchildren not to become involved in the military or in so-called law enforcement in any way. Because already the government is ordering and inveigling these people into doing unspeakable things, things that ultimately, in my opinion, endanger their very soul. And I think that's where the rubber is starting to hit the road. We are looking at a situation where you have to look at your children and grandchildren and say, oh my, there's no way I can let this person, this man or boy or girl or whatever, get involved in this, because they will be inveigled into doing unspeakable things to their fellow Americans. And that power structure, the precedents, legal, the emergency controls, our relentless interventions abroad, which fuel the kinds of tensions and retribution that we have seen and can expect more of, it just goes into this boiling cauldron into which have been thrown the last of the Bill of Rights, effectively, and the well-being of citizens, and really has destroyed the basic concept of law enforcement, which was the common law idea of the peace officer. When was the last time you ever heard someone with a badge referred to as a peace officer? They've effectively been militarized, and they are on the de facto take because of the tremendous federal subsidies they're getting for extra manpower and money, et cetera, to fight the so-called drug war, which is totally useless, counterproductive, and hasn't had one scintilla of positive benefit. You've got, what, 1.25 million people dying from obesity in this country every year is a direct cause, and I believe you've got about 5,000 people dying primarily from drug overdoses or what have you. Well, why aren't Twinkies illegal? And I'm not trying to make a pragmatic argument there. What I'm trying to say is the real price of freedom isn't paying taxes and, you know, recycling and so on. The real price of freedom, which virtually no one in this country will pay, is you have to exercise the maturity and the adult sensibility to realize that if you want to live in a free society, you're going to be around an awful lot of people doing an awful lot of things that you really don't like. And as soon as you sick the government on those people, you're diminishing your own well-being and certainly destroying the freedom legacy for your children and grandchildren. And it's sinister. It's sinister. You tell someone, well, the government, they say, the government's too big, they say to you, I've had it, too much regulation, this or that. and then ask these people, say, well, does your town, where do you live? Oh, I live in this wonderful little town called Maryville or wherever. Say, well, do you have a bike path? Yeah, we have a beautiful bike path along our river. I said, well, when did they build it? Well, they built it 25 years ago. Who built it? Well, we got matching funds from the state, and we got matching funds from the Department of the Interior, and then you ask them to say, well, how did they clear the path? Well, they used eminent domain. There were a couple of holdouts. There was an old lady living along near that path, and they finally got her out of there and got her into an old folks home. They got her in court, and she finally gave up. That's the level it starts at. Those are the kinds of seeds, and they're sinister because people overlook those. They might see the big issues. They might see a semi-automatic military-style rifle ban in Congress. They see these big things, but they don't realize that what they're really looking at is the legacy of maybe thousands of those kinds of bike path precedents, where people, just out of self-accommodation and a lack of sensitivity or a lack of forethought, which, of course, we're all victim to in one sense or another, go along with the state. And all of a sudden, you got something that's a lot bigger, meaner, and more insensitive and dangerous than you could ever have imagined.
This is all fascinating stuff, Bob, and I'm just wondering, I'm sure there are some people out there who would really like to know what services you might offer to them and how to contact you.
Our trading group is really what's called a boutique in that we're intensely personal in our client relationships. Our specialty is options, which can give you the potential of low risk or fixed risk and very low cost ways to play various scenarios in all sorts of different markets. We also specialize in helping people build very conservative but very low cost gold positions in their portfolios. And even we develop ways in which they can actually, through options, earn what we would call, in quotes, interest income on their gold, which is normally impossible to do. We also trade foreign currencies very actively, and for our clients who are actively trading those currencies, we offer a very fine service that sells for about $1,800 a year, and we've arranged with the advisor who sells that to make that free with no extra costs or hidden charges to clients who are actively in the foreign currency options. So in essence, we are a full currency specialty firm in options, commodities, stock indexes, interest rates, and related areas. And we publish about 70 special reports a year with specific option recommendations and everything from orange juice right through to government bonds and the U.S. dollar and the euro and whatever else you could possibly imagine in the commodity financial area. And I founded the company in 1984, and we're doing very well. And our whole philosophy is to treat people in such a way that we develop long-term relationships.
How can a serious investor contact you?
They can contact me by calling the following toll-free number, 800-345-7026. That's 800-345-7026. And when they call, they should mention the show.
That, of course, is Talking to America by JPFO.org.
And request our short course in futures and options. It's a wonderful little quick study handbook on how to use futures and options contracts. And also our most recent research report, which at this time happens to be on crude oil. And that will give them a very, very good idea of what we do and whether or not they choose to go forward with us. People will benefit immensely from reading the handbook on futures and options.
Is the 800 number the only number to contact you at?
Well, if they are outside the United States or that line is busy, they can call our regular number, which is 312-528-3445. That's 312-528-3445. And we don't have an answering machine. So when you call, you will get a licensed trader, and they will take very good care of whoever might be interested.
Are there some requirements for people to work with your special firm?
With low activity, special situation, longer term option portfolios, we have a $10,000 minimum to start. And for the gold storage and special gold programs we offer, the starting minimum is $20,000 to $25,000. And the foreign currency advisory service is about $1,800. But if you're actively trading currencies, there's no charge for that, nor is any charge added to your brokerage commissions for that.
Well, Bob, I want to thank you very much for being with us today. It's been very insightful. Hopefully it's motivated some people to look around and see what's really going on in our world. They won't like what they see. So again, our special guest today has been Robert Meyer, and I've been your host, Aaron Zellman. This has been Talking to America, and I want to remind you that if you won't defend your rights, don't complain when you lose them.
Opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily reflect those of JPFO.org or its members. Talking to America is a production of JPFO.org.